March 25th. I'd like to make the committee aware of a very nice fax, unlike the other one I received from an individual named Rand. This one comes from Warren Rand, who said, "Dear Mr. Westland, I'd be happy to get you any tickets I could possibly obtain that had anything remotely to do with good and culturally significant music. I don't know if that includes the aforementioned Ozzy Osbourne tickets or not. I can't, you know, I think you've told
about Osbourne.
So I just wanted everyone to, you know, in the latest on this, the, email works down there, really, Phyllis. The, any announcements from staff?
No, Chair.
Any announcements for the good of the order?
Yes.
Oh, no.
Yes.
I just wanted to thank staff and the chair for putting together the excellent report and cover memo. I appreciated all the hard work.
Mm. Well, hey, we're just beginning. I mean, we are going, it's one of the things we're doing today, is figuring out how we can start to combine some of the mental health, carve out some of the mental health and include some of it, as ironic as those statements seem. And that's what we're going to be doing for the next week, 10 days, is how do we reduce those recommendations, which I don't know about you guys, but I've heard, you know, very good, had very good response to both sides of the aisle, both sides of the building. So I feel, you know, I'm not pleased that we're talking about the numbers that are going off the health plan, but I'm very proud of that product, mm-hmm. and it's a product that can be built on, and that was one of the key concerns. So anyway, hey, good job. We're doing okay. Again, we're continuing with our informational meetings, invited testimony. Today we hear from our good friends from Lane County who are with us again, Bruce Abel, and his mother is here, and Bruce's daughter. So, and I think they're going on like vacation, like instantly, as soon as you leave. And considering that my wife is walking through that door with my two kids at 4:30, we will be done. I mean, I'm only saying this to get you out of here on vacation.
So be brief.
Yeah, we'll be done by 4:30. Anyway, let me call Bruce Abel, Rob Rockstro, and Terry Copeland, and as I think we all know, today we're going to talk about physical mental health collaboration in Lane County, and they're going to make comments to us as to OHP mental health cost containment ideas. Gentlemen, enter, sign in, please, and as you'll remember the drill, develop a very friendly relationship with those microphones. Otherwise, the folks in the back, your mom can't hear that. You know, I want your mom to be able to hear this. Please proceed. When I try, you know, Representative Cruz.
Hi. There's her paw.
Right.
All right, no distractions. Gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Rob Rockstro. I'm the director of Lane County Health and Human Services, even though it says Lane Care on the document. Lane Care is one of the programs operating in my department, and Bruce is the Lane Care manager. Actually, I don't have a prepared statement or testimony right now. What I thought I was going to be doing is that we have some question and answers. Plus, I'm involved a little bit differently than just a mental health, behavioral health collaboration. I'm also working with a committee that's working with the Senator Jackie Winters on what is called, strangely enough, the Perfect Human Service Delivery System. And it's actually a collaboration beyond mental health, and it includes public health, Commissioned Children and Families, some other things. So I can bring some of that information to the table if it's necessary, but I think the presentation today is largely between Bruce and Terry Copeland.
Very good. Thanks, Rob.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Bruce Abel. I'm the manager of Lane Care in Lane County. It's the MHO carve-out component of the Oregon Health Plan, providing mental health services. And Rob is my boss.
Good to see you again.
Awesome.
Both of you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Terry Copeland. I am the CEO of LIPA, and we cover physical health care in Lane County. Currently, we have about 30,000 lives under management in Lane County.
Great.
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
How many fee for service? I mean,
we think there's about somewhere between 6,000 and 9,000 fee for service. It depends on the time of the month, and the reports differ.
Okay, thank you.
Proceed ahead.
I think we all came here assuming this was a question and answer. The one thing that we did bring for your review, Lane County and Lane Care are in a negotiation discussion with OMHAS in figuring out ways to integrate various components.
Wait, what?
OMHAS, the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. And as you may know, there's a whole lot of different ways that contracts and funds flow for different mental health services and for addiction services, chemical dependency treatment services. And we have been in discussion with this vision, this idea that by integrating these funding streams, these dollars, there's federal dollars, there's state dollars, there's local dollars, there's matched and unmatched general fund dollars. There's a multiplicity of contracts. There's a whole lot of different ways that people are paid. They submit their claims. The data is tracked. And we're sort of in discussions to see whether it makes sense to have a single contract instead of a block grant type approach, and manage those resources and the services locally so that care decisions can be made without the restrictions of categorical funding and make the best decisions we can for individuals in the moment. And maybe save administrative dollars so we can put more dollars into services.
Heaven forbid. Here's a fundamental question. I think, as you gentlemen all know, certainly Terry does, we've recommended as public policy that the fully capped absorb the fee-for-service population. I think that's why Representative Cruz asked that number. And I assume through communications with Bill Murray and several others over at the provider, or at the contractors group, you were made aware of that and have some ideas as to the direction we're going.
Yeah.
Okay, that's our concept. Terry, how do we do that? How do we make it work for you, you know, as a contractor? How does that work for the state? How can we both serve each other in this and give what I anticipate will be better access and medical coverage to, at this juncture, an underserved population?
Actually, I think the implementation is a lot more simple than you would think.
Oh, bless you. I haven't found one thing simple about this whole damn deal yet. So, I mean,
that's why I believe that this would be more simple than you think.
Oh.
More complicated than you would like.
Oh.
What I would recommend, and I've written a concept paper on this, in fact, what I would recommend is that all benefit designs, and when I say benefit designs, I'm referring to it as an insurance company would look at OHP Plus, OHP Standard, and the open card patients, that they're all part of the same health plan, just with different benefit designs, and that the management of those by one entity in the community and with a community-based care model is actually not too complex. You would really divide the risk up based on the amount of management that you do for each of those benefit designs. For example, OHP Plus might be a full risk model, just as it is now for the fully capitated health plans. OHP standard would then be a partial risk. Maybe the fully capitated health plans would share risk with the state, and the claims would be paid out of a shared fund, or the way we do it with commercial employers right now. And that there be a managed care light program applied to the standard population. And then the open card perhaps would be 100% risk by the state and none by the fully capitated health plan. But the fully capitated health plan would then pay the claims and include those patients in disease registries and all of the other things that's easy to include them in. One of the things that does is that it reduces the difficulties we have now of patients who are on the plan 1 month, off the plan. We have a 10% rolling on and off type of attrition rate every month on our plans. So in 3 months, for example, with our plan, there's 30,000 patients have rolled onto and off the health plan. So if we're managing all of these patients under one administrative structure, and by the way, the administrative costs would be different for each of these depending on what the functions you do. So you wouldn't necessarily have I'm just throwing these numbers out. They have no basis in reality, but maybe.
May I ask a question, Mr. Chair?
Of course.
The rolling on and rolling off, what do they roll off to? I mean, would they stay in the system you designed, you just envisioned? Because my impression is that they roll off of Medicaid eligibility.
It's a mixture. Most of them roll off of our plan into open card and then back. Many of them do roll off the plan entirely, and then 6 months later they might come back.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cruz.
Let's assume that all three of those populations have the same benefit package. Does that change the dynamic?
It would. It would change the way we manage them. But you simply change the risk structure, and you change how much managed care you want to do on them. But the concept is still the same.
Okay. One of the drivers of this certainly is risk, and the assumption of risk, and who assumes it. I guess when you said the state would assume all the risk for what we're now calling an open card, which would be, but if we're rolling them into the managed care system, then doesn't the plan assume some risk for that population at that point in time?
Well, certainly we could.
Okay.
I'm just putting it as a concept. There's a continuum of risk.
Right.
Okay. And you can define it however you want.
Okay.
But that's just in broad strokes on how I see it.
Thank you.
From just a comment on that from the MHO perspective, we're discussing moving the open card clients in with this full service carve out, as we're calling it. And there's an assumption that we would take on some risk with that also, as with other aspects of what we would roll into it. So if we rolled in, for instance, DARTS day treatment or residential treatment, we're actually talking about rolling in the state psychiatric hospital dollars for the Lane County portion of the folks in the hospital. And so you can move those dollars into the county, and then we would manage all those locally, pay for them if we had to put someone into the hospital, but if we had to put more people in the hospital than we did in previous years, we would be at risk for that. Now, how all that risk plays itself out is not clear right now. And, you know, Rob sitting next to me is going to say, we're not going to take on more risk than is reasonable. But with the incentives in the right place, you can make local decisions, you can make good care decisions that hopefully reduce the amount of very high-end treatments that are very costly also.
Mr. Chair, one of the things we've been talking about in here was the fact that historically the physical side has kind of
stolen, maybe a strong word, but appropriated money from the mental health side and usurped? Okay, I didn't know the technical term there.
Those are both awfully strong words for somebody who works on that side.
Okay. Well, and so...
Ripped off?
The conversation's going the wrong way.
Okay. In other words, there's some money over here that maybe should be over here. But one of the things we've talked about is you know, especially the severe and chronic who need the intense services, that the dollars should follow the people. And I'm quite trying to figure out how that jives with you, because you're talking about buying slots, right, at the state hospital?
No.
Okay. Then explain to me.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cruz, I think one of the issues, and I've talked to you about it before, is how the whole system works. And the idea is not to buy slots in the hospital. The idea is actually to take the hospital beds. Like, I was entitled to 10% of the state beds. Give me the money of 10% of the state beds. Give me your admin cost, and we'll figure a way to manage it. The other thing I need to let you know at the same time, and because I think it's one of, I consider it an error in the draft document. I'm not sure if that's the plan you're talking about. And it's an error that I've made in the past, too. It has to do with the serious, persistent, mentally ill. The SPMI-labeled people aren't necessarily our high-end people. When I've talked in the past about high-end people, they can be people who blow out temporarily who don't actually have that label. Plus, we know within the system there are people who have chronic mental illness that basically last a lifetime, that aren't real expensive for us. So one of the ways, when you, I think about the system, under the old fee-for-service system, you had no incentive not to churn the system. I mean,
right.
Bad system. Under managed care, you had incentives to control costs. So we think in Lane County, we spend a lot of money on services. So our argument is one of the ways to tell is look for who you spent money on in the past. That should tell you something. So, for example, if you compare across the state how people spent their money, with incentives to save, anybody who spent a lot on that client basically was making an argument they needed that service. It's a different way to look at it. So basically looked at the demand and the service you provided as opposed to the label. So it's just an interesting way to look at it, but I'll keep calling them high-end clients as opposed to SPMI, even though many of them are will have a serious persistent mentally ill label. And it's I'm still frustrated with not being able to get a real feel statewide how many people truly are these high-end clients. For example, we started looking at the system, how many clients cost more than X dollars per year, because that's the way you have to control the cost. I mean, you have to figure out what your high-end costs are. And I'm not worried about soft mental health. Somebody has some sort of grief over a weekend that's transient or something. Having said that, we will serve that client currently. That's not the base I'm talking about. I want to make sure it's a public policy argument with limited funding. We care for the people who really have the high-end needs, as opposed to a high-end label.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up. I mean, you know, I think we know and we've heard that a lot of the folks at the state hospital that are civilly committed could probably do just as well, if not better, in community settings. And I have no problem with keeping those in the communities. But there's a percent of those that probably don't do well in group homes, and certainly the forensic population doesn't. So, but and part of that is yours. So,
having said that, we are talking to them in the plan of actually doing some stuff for forensics, either the unfit to proceed or the PSRB clients, because we're actually willing to take some of them on.
Okay.
In the past, for example, I have a DD home of five people, PSRB DD clients. They've actually worked out fine. Now I'm not going to compare a developmentally disabled PSRB client to mentally ill PSRB client, but one of the things that can occur is because of the oddities of budgets and the vagaries of the state, right now my sheriff has probably a wing or two available in his jail. We're talking to the jail the possibility of people who had been sent to the state for unfit to proceed. If it works out okay, we could do a wing in the jail. So rather than exporting people back and forth, it's just an oddity that may occur right now. So we're actually looking at talking. Our county, the sheriff actually has some of his own mental health staff. We're willing to look at it as a piece of the pilot, carving out the whole universe. We did not think a few months ago we'd think that way, but because it came up, we're willing to look at that. So we are willing to take high-end clients.
Okay, we didn't think any county would
be foolish enough to do that.
Well, yeah, and you guys, you, are, you know, pretty unique and integrated, and several reasons for that. One of them is management, one of them is geographic, and, I mean, what you do and how you do it is, I think, an example all over the state. So if that's one county, maybe there are some more. That would not be, I mean, you're not going to be able to shut down the forensics wing at the state hospital.
Well, another comment, too. I mean, part of it is, I mean, this is all for a fee. I mean, this is an insurance company. This is a business. It's not like these people come out cheap because they're not cheap at the state hospital either. And obviously, I have to convince my commissioners of the risk, but they have sort of given me instructions to go ahead and try to design a pretty comprehensive system under the idea of Lane County has been exporting kids for years. We just never develop high-end kid residential services. And part of it, because if you don't understand the history of how pilots worked in the state, if you bid on them years ago, you had one. But if you didn't own one, so for example, I would argue we do not have our share of high-end child services in Lane County. It's an oddity. We have lots of services, but not that. So we actually send kids out of county for service, and we're trying to stop that. And that's a big driver to the county about how to do that.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know what PSRB is, and I would like to request, gentlemen, that you speak in English rather than letters. It would be very helpful.
Okay.
But we won't fine you.
They do in some committees, you know.
Do you want to explain what PSRB is?
Sure.
Okay. PSRB is Psychiatric Security Review Board. So basically, if you get adjudicated, you get picked up for a crime, and you basically are guilty except for mental illness. Instead of going to prison, you will go to the state hospital. One of the differences are if you go to prison, you can get out for good behavior. Technically, on PSRB, you can be held for the whole period of time of the crime. So what happens is frequently you will stay in the hospital a long time, but if you're not, you can be released to the community on certain methods. But part of it gets to be when you say criminally insane to people, because that's the way people commonly talk about it, they think of Hannibal Lecters. Not true in a lot of cases. A lot of times these are just people who can be relatively safe in the community, and part of it is to, if there really are Hannibal Lecter types, we really don't want those in the community. And it probably is appropriate to have some hospital beds of the state backing up the system, because I don't like it if the state is not my partner in beds, too. I mean, I actually like it when they have some risk with us. And I think it's a good deal, but I think they can have a lot smaller institutions for the criminally insane or for some other forensic type patients.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Sorry to use those words.
That's right. There's sometimes also they have group homes, for example, in the community where that are run by these they call them PSRB homes.
Right.
So, and they're usually a siting issue. Dr. Bates.
I want to try to make sure I kind of understand the broad breadth of what you're suggesting here, which, frankly, I fully support. It's a great idea. You're talking about trying to change utilization for these patients, keeping them out of the hospital primarily. I assume a wraparound service for them, and that's the way you would avoid that. Gives them a better quality of life. I would assume you would, if you don't already have, you would consider having beds of some type available in your county that you would utilize instead of the more expensive state beds, which also allows you a Medicaid match for those who are qualified. I also expect that if you wrap this into one fund, you could do what some of the other counties have talked to me about of using funds that are available at the county level that would not match federally in not a good way. Funds coming in from funds from the cities or the counties themselves, their general funds for them, that for those patients that qualified for Medicaid, you could use to get a higher Medicaid match. I'm kind of making those kind of assumptions. Mm-hmm. That's what you're building into this, trying to leverage more money and control utilization. Now, I'd hope also that you obviously want to cut down administrative costs, which with all these various streams of money flowing in and all the oversight the state has to give each one of those, that some of those administrative costs could be eliminated. Now, that strikes me as those administrative costs occur primarily at the state level, not the county level, and that would be something that we'd have to work with you on. I would think that to eliminate that. I also assume you're talking about a population of people who are not only OHP plus, an OHP standard, but that other group out there for which there's a substantial amount of money coming down, several hundred million, that are on Medicare or who have some income that keeps them off the Medicaid program, for which you still have to treat them for their chronic or persistent mental illnesses. And so I assume you're wrapping all those into one group and trying to bring the flow of revenue into one setting also. And that's what you're looking at,
mm-hmm.
trying to cut this whole thing down to something you get your hands around that is more central, and then you take the risk for that and manage it on a countywide basis. You want to do that as a pilot program. There's some complexities here. I share the chair's concerns about maybe it's not as complex as I think it is, but I am very much thankful for you stepping up and thinking that you can think outside the box and resolve some of these issues, because we know the system we have now is cumbersome and expensive, more expensive probably than it should be for the actual care that's delivered. So I'm assuming that my summation is roughly what you're talking about. Is there anything I said that you disagreed with?
I think it's roughly what we have talked about. Plus, the other thing, just remind people, too, whether it's an IPA doing the physical health, they've done a good job of managing the
IPA?
Care. Oh, I'm sorry. Individual Practitioner Association? Is that the right way to say it? The doctors, when they get together. Physician Association, sorry.
Well, of course, I'm on a golf course. That's different.
Yeah. It's when the docs get together, make their own company. And the other one is the mental health organizations, which actually were counties in the state, several years ago had no ability or had no background in actually doing managed care in an insurance model. But we've all sort of done it differently, and I think part of it is people have built up their skill bases. The IPAs have done it for a while on their own, and everybody's done it a little bit differently. But I think we've all learned a lot in the last few years. We know what the risk is and where it's not, and at least we know what questions to ask about it.
Well, hold on. Go ahead. Both of you guys comment. Go ahead. Bruce.
Thank you.
To that point.
Yeah, Representative Bates. Two additions that I had, and I have to remember the second one now. The first one is that our interest here is to preserve a minimum infrastructure to meet the mental health needs of the citizens of our county. As you all know, there's been very significant reductions, and it threatens the very infrastructure. And we're hoping that in sometime in the future we can build on what remains and restore some things. One of the populations you failed to mention, as you mentioned the Oregon Health Plan, the Medicaid, Medicare, is the indigent population. And we used to receive funds to support crisis, acute care, and just indigent care for adults and children, and that's including vocational services, and that's been cut entirely, just under $1 million in Lane County, and so there's really no resources for that population now. The other point I wanted to make is when you talked about the administration being mostly in savings in the state, I think that's probably true, but I hope that it's more than a trickle down. I hope it's sort of some other pass downs. And for instance, if you look at the other side and you look at the providers, right now a provider agency will have to complete maybe a half dozen contracts with the county, with the state, and with each of those contracts they will need to submit data and counter data, billing data in different ways. And what we're hoping is that we can integrate all those dollars and significantly reduce the number of contracts and have a single way that services are billed, that data is tracked, that claims are paid. And so we'll have a comprehensive data set. We can really know what services are being provided, at least in Lane County. Right now, to go out and try and get information about, you know, how many kids were served in day treatment, how many kids in the state hospital, how many folks are getting 7-Eleven meds, it's very complicated to get a complete data set. So we're hoping that this would do that also.
Jerry, do you want to expand on that?
Yes. I think what you guys are asking is going, in my opinion, is going in absolutely going the correct direction. That's the integration of services. I would posit that the vertical integration rather than horizontal integration would really have get the most bang for your buck. And what I mean by that is that vertical integration would be just as we're proposing here, that all of the administrative structures under mental health be combined. Same thing under the physical health. Administrative structures under the physical health be combined on the other side. That is vertical integration. The horizontal integration of taking, say, the SPM, the Securely and Persistent Mental Ill, and maybe carving them out, that's horizontal integration and is less efficient. I just put for you, passed out this little deal here just to give you an example of the cost. We have in Lane County, because of a grant that we received from the state about a year and a half ago, we've been able to put together a comprehensive database of mental health, physical health, and chemical prescription drug cost from all sources. And this is the probably the only place in the state you'll be able to find this. So we were able to put together the cost and just a real simple report that shows you the percent that Oregon Lane OHP, that's LIPA, would pay just for the SPMI. We actually cover 63.7% of the cost. Lane Care covers 10.9%. Med Impact is our pharmacy cost. That's our PBM. And so 14.47% is paid out through our pharmacy. And then First Health is the state's, and that's the 7-Eleven drugs. So you can see that the way that those expenses are carved out, it makes it awkward to horizontally integrate services like this. So I just wanted to address that issue on what I thought about this.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
I'm missing some letters here. I mean, there are a lot of letters I don't understand. LOHP and SPMI and LCPMI and LCMI and all other.
I apologize, Representative Tomei. LOHP is LIPA. That's the physical health side.
Okay.
Lane Care is these guys, the mental health side.
Okay.
Med Impact is really part of LIPA, but that's what we pay through our pharmacy. Those
Got
are
it.
All pharmacy drugs paid out through the physical health side. And First Health is what the state OMAP pays for 7-Eleven drugs.
Okay, and
and all of these rows are the different categories of the mental health folks.
And I can explain those for you. If you
Thank
the
you.
SPMI population are folks that are typically diagnosed with a schizophrenia or psychosis, and that by anyone's definition are serious and persistently mentally ill.
Okay.
The LCPMI are other very high-end utilizers, and some folks would define them as having a serious and persistent mental illness. It's the bipolar folks, some PTSD might be in there.
No.
Oh, bipolar is manic depression, post-traumatic distress type disorders. They can be very expensive to treat. The LCMI was a population that was not any of the two above, but they were in treatment at Lane Care for a mental health problem. So that could range anything from an adjustment to the birth of a new child, to a death of someone, to sex abuse, recovering from sex abuse, you know, and any sort of things. The all others were folks that were covered both by LIPA and by Lane Care, but never accessed a mental health treatment through Lane Care.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And Representative Tomei, I appreciate you clarifying, keeping these guys, you know, on their toes, because
that's why I'm here.
Representative March doesn't know what these acronyms mean either. You know.
But he didn't want
to. Representative Greenland.
Only the people that have been initiated into the secret society. Under ordinary circumstances, we'd have to kill you once we've told you.
You lose your hair, Representative Tomei, if you know what these mean.
Representative Cruz yesterday was talking about care management models, and you're talking about some experience in the management of risk, which is very important in the management of dollars, and that really helps when you get these all into a single pot, although from this table, the pot of people with purely physical illness is missing, I assume. And I assume that gets into the pot as well and their mental health. But the real question is, how do you develop systematic, I think it's pretty horizontal, how do you develop systematic care management models where you really start managing care in addition to managing risk when you have this range of and I'll use the term now, SPMI, I mean, from a kind of whacked out long-term schizophrenic to a bipolar disorder that pops in and out of manic episodes and into serious depressive episodes to somebody with persistent anxiety disorders. How it, how do you think about this in terms of the way you manage care, which is the obvious basis for managing risk?
I think I know your question. I'm sorry. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, there is a document here that we have. Bruce, we have here somewhere. Now, what it is, obviously, this whole thing is driven by client services. I mean, that's the driver, which I should have talked about a bit earlier. Part of it is just having some experience with these clients. We just know how they operate. But they also, the other thing, what we're trying to do right now with the state, we have the spreadsheet of all these different matrices, how these clients play out. And so what we have, and you don't have it, it's this big matrix sheet that basically, just for example, gives us headers of historical data, anticipated state pilot funds, by just a listing of service components. For example, Open Card, Medicaid, not Oregon Health Plan, Hospital Forensics, Forensics Residential, Hospital Kids, Hospital Adults, ECMU. It goes this broad list of stuff that basically calculates what the state is putting in there right now, and it gets down into occasional crisis services, gambling, and administration. So what we will do is basically know, based on our experience, how services have been allocated, get from the state what they have for some population data that we're missing, and actually analyze and try to put it together. And part of it is actually working with some of the people who worked with LIFE and some of the people who worked with us, and trying to, you look at all that data, know what you've served in the past, and start estimating your risk based on that. It really is an insurance model, but it's probably the difference we would bring to the table compared to most insurance companies is one of the ideas is we don't disappear. We had carriers in the past came to our county and disappeared. We don't get the privilege if things don't work out, it'll disappear. The county still will be there providing services. So we're going to try to figure a way to marry all this data with what we already know in managed care, what we've already done, get this new information, and actually come up with a new formula. I mean, we're going to spend our next few months analyzing the data to see if we can really pull this off. Because what we're giving you now is a concept, and we're arrogant enough to believe that we could pull it off. And I still think we can pull it off.
Except that's not what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Let me see if I can.
Okay.
It's late in the afternoon. It's been a long day. I'm not talking about managing dollars at all. I'm talking about you have a chronic schizophrenic who's 55 years old and is been in big trouble and shows up. The question is, what do you do? This isn't about money. It's you have some better way of treating that person, and at the same time, a bipolar disorder person who's now in the middle of a manic episode, you have some way of managing those in ways that would be analogous to the way we're trying to manage diabetics or people with congestive heart failure, things like that. Now, that will make this work because it works at the ground. Gotcha. It works at the clinical level.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, I think the difference is a service delivery model. Tied with some of this, and definitely around our way of thinking has been, our way of thinking so far has been primarily around dual diagnosis client. We know that an awful lot of the public client we have is mentally ill, comes with, you know, some substance abuse label. It happens frequently. So one of the things we want to try to do, and it's one of the principles in here, is try to get a dual diagnosis model without terrorizing A&D providers. I mean, it's one of the issues that goes on out there is a view in the world that mental health will take over the A&D system. We're trying to figure a way, and we will invite the A&D providers and alcohol and drug providers, everybody into the system to talk about how do we do it differently. I mean, to a certain degree, we have those issues right now. It's just they're in separate pools. So, for example, we will get that person to come in, but my mental health staff has created a dual diagnosis unit. No one ever paid for it in the state, but we know as a practical matter we've had to do it. We also had some grant monies we've done in the past. We've also done a lot of forensic work at the sheriff's office just because we relate with them a lot. So I think what you do not see in here, we have not created the service delivery model that this begs the question on that. I mean, it's still a concept paper. You're 100% correct. If we don't change the service delivery model, all we've done is basically put the money together, but not the service delivery, and the intent is to put both together as much as possible.
Bruce, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I'm going to take a stab at that answer a little bit differently. Lane County has a very different way of managing the MHO than other counties. We have a full partnership with our providers and with consumers. So they have the same decision-making in our governance structure as I do. And we, when we look at our resources, we sit with our providers and we say, these are the resources, the maximum amount of resources we can allocate to services. Let's figure out how to allocate them. And then so each agency says, this is how much I need to serve this many clients. And then we monitor that with them throughout the year, and they say, well, we're serving way more clients, and then we give them additional funds to cover those. So it's not like where we say, you know, on an individual basis, you can only have $1,000 for this patient. Our care managers don't step in until an individual has cost us, I think, $7,000 approximately. So we do not a whole lot of care management, but a lot of system coordination. If this full service pilot project were to happen, we'd have significantly more funds to manage locally. We'd be able to do more rapid response to those individuals that are having some rapid onset of some disorder or some escalation of a chronic disorder, and we'd have the acute hospital, we'd have the subacute hearing center, we'd have the residential crisis stabilization program, Royal Avenue program, we would have foster homes, we're talking about having a consumer-operated residential program. When there'd be an immediate response to move someone from a lower level to a higher level of care, and then to move that person back down to a lower level of care. Representative Bates talked about the wraparound approach. The best service is provided to a person in their home, in their community, in their school, with their naturally existing support group. And to the extent that this full service pilot project results in dollars being put on the table, and then all those rules that currently govern those dollars are relaxed, it's more of a laid-back system, and we can say, you know, what this person really needs to stay in their home is someone who can do house cleaning once a week, help them with their shopping, and we'll call in and check how they're doing every day. And if that phone call isn't answered, then they go to the house and visit them, and if the person needs additional services, you bring that to them. Rather than having that person brought to the emergency room, hospitalized for 12 days, we're looking at creating that consumer-friendly system that gets the appropriate service at the earliest time that it can be provided and a need is identified.
Good luck.
Thank you. We just want the chance to do it.
Representative Bates.
Nicely spoken, by the way.
Thank you.
The sheet you just handed us?
Yes.
Very, very concise, very simple, but also very interesting, and I want to ask a couple of questions about
certainly.
It. Okay. This is, as an example, go to the first line for the severely persistent mentally ill SPMI, which I had to think about what that meant, too, so don't feel bad about it.
I don't feel at all bad.
Yeah. You've got the first column there is what you call LIPA, which is your physical medicine. I assume that percentage is a result of diagnosis codes that represented physical health problems. Is that correct or incorrect?
No, that's correct, yes.
And the next line over would probably be written with
Representative
LIPA.
Bates, I'm sorry, I don't hear very well. Could you speak a little bit louder?
The first column under LIPA was probably physical health diagnosis codes. These are people who have severe persistent mentally ill problems, went and saw a physician for something physical. Next line over was, I would assume, would be for mental diagnosis codes.
May I just describe it a little bit?
Yeah.
It might help. Think of the SPMI as one person. And of that one person, 41% of his or her services were physical. Of expenses for services were physical health. 24% were mental health from Lane Care, which is a little bit different from mental health from LIPO, by the way. And then 11% of that person's expense
was for pharmaceuticals that came from LIPA for drugs that were administered by primary care physicians, probably. And then 23.4% were for drugs that were paid for by the state, and those are the 7-Eleven. Does that make more sense?
It does, and that's exactly where I was going. And the question that arises in my mind is that since we commonly see these patients in our offices, is whether or not in the kind of program you're describing, if more of the percentage could flow to Lane Care, which goes back to Representative Cruz's suggestion, as you gain better control of these people and they gain better control of their lives, my expectation is they would spend less time in the physical side of medicine, dramatically less time, and the overall cost of the program could be reduced. Now, my personal feeling is that a more intense wraparound program for these people, this is very anecdotal, so I can't give you big data for it, and it's the best I've ever seen, frankly, would in the long run save the entire system huge amounts of money and keep these people of the doctor's office for imagined or unreal or psychotropic type of stuff going on. They just have a lot of aches and pains and concerns that aren't real because of their mental illness.
I think that's probably a good assessment, but 80% of the mental health care is delivered by the primary care physicians in general, in a global sense. So it would be difficult to redirect all of those patients, I think, over to Lane Care. I mean, we'd be glad to send them over.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. I think when we think of that 70-80% figure, that because we know it's real, but that's usually for people who have what I consider significant but minor in comparison to this.
Depression.
We're talking about depression and anxiety patients, which easily can be dealt with in the primary care physician's office. You're talking about a different group of people here, at least in line one and two. And those are the people that, as far as hospitals and emergency rooms are concerned, use up huge amounts of resources if they're not managed under Lane Care. And I think that's where the savings are at. And I would assume your LIPA is picking up the bill for a lot of emergency room work, hospitalized work, which could be avoided if we could get them into a wraparound service through Lane Care. Is that correct? Is that where we're going here?
These are very expensive patients, Representative Bates. I suspect that the cost for these patients are probably somewhere between $500 and $600 PMPM if you look at the total cost.
If you look at this sheet,
I'm squinting.
I think this was distributed to you.
Oh. I'm probably still squinting.
But he didn't ask you to look at your sheet. He asked you to look at that sheet.
If you look at your sheet, that looks like this sheet.
This sheet.
One thing I will say, and you may be interested in this, LIPA and Lane Care have the best data set in the state for integrated data set right now. And we've been reviewing it and looking at it and showing it a little bit. So all these analyses are coming out of this. This sheet will show you, I think, what you're asking, what are the medical costs for those same different populations. So if you look down, you'll see in each of the rows the different medical costs. Now, I don't know what all the medical diagnoses are, but you can see that the mental health cost, which I think is the fourth one down, starts off at almost $130 per member per month for that serious persistent mentally ill, drops to half that for the second group, stays about the same for the third group, and then drops way down for the all others, those folks who never accessed Lane Care. And that's probably for those treatments, seeing the physicians for getting antidepressants or anti-anxiety medications. The final comment here, if you go to the bottom row, you'll see how much more expensive is the SPMI population, the serious and persistently mentally ill. They're four times as expensive for all of their health care than is the all other, those folks who never accessed mental health treatment.
That's amazing. that's a thank you for the documentation. Jerry.
Mr. Chairman, I think what Representative Bates says has a lot of validity, but part of my concern, though, with the horizontal integration is also that it creates some administrative inefficiency so that you can see the level of physical health that would have to be managed by Lane Care for these patients in setting up contracts and arrangements and payment systems to cover all of that is a duplication of services.
Any other questions on the kind of coordination?
I want to go back to Terry.
I understand. I'm talking about combining the fee-for-service into managed care, and I will allow that there were several of us on this committee that had some real skepticisms about managed care when we first sat down, and have since come to believe that the managed care organizations are the backbone of the healthcare delivery system in this state. So we appreciate what you do, and we appreciate, you know, how you do it. I mean, good job, and thank you. I know I speak on behalf of the whole committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So my question is this, you know, what you do, and the reason it works, is you assume risk, and you manage for that risk. So if the state, on the fee-for-service population, you know, assumes all that risk, where do the savings come from? What's the incentive? How does that work?
Currently, and again, I was describing a concept that had a continuum of risk and management. But if you assumed no risk under the fee-for-service group, and yet some management, some level of management, depending however much level the state wanted, it would work the way it currently works for us with our contracts with employers. We contract directly with employer groups where the employer under ERISA takes all of the risk for their employees. But we manage the care for their patients as though they were in a managed care plan. And they pay us to do that.
So, and I guess that's my question. How are you paid?
Well, they pay us on a per employee per month basis. So we've arrived at a price that they would pay us based on the number of services, managed care services that we do for them. And so they give us a monthly administrative fee for that. And it's not a percentage, it's a base fee per employee per month.
Per member per month.
Per employee per month.
That's what you do with the employee. I'm trying to equate this to us trying to...
Right. Per member per month would work as well. For an employer, there may be...
Dependents as well.
Yeah, the dependents as well. So... And for us, we manage the care, and all of our employers over the last 3 years have had between 6% and 8% cost increases for health care for their employees per year. And if you compare that with the commercial markets, you would see that we've done a good job. And the motivation for us to do a really good job, even without risk, is that we want the contract next year, too. And we can't afford to have an employer blow up under our watch. But, I mean, that's kind of that's the motivation piece.
May I have the chair?
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I still am trying to grasp the model that you're proposing. And I'll compare it to there seems to be a lot more case management for a mental health patient than for one with physical problems. I mean, usually someone gets sick and they get well, or they are hospitalized and have an operation and then they get well. I need to understand your case management better on when you say, oh, if someone doesn't respond, they're at home, you then would send someone to go visit them. You know, that was said earlier. Tell me a little bit about case management and who it doesn't matter.
On the physical health side, we have nurse RN case managers, actually a lot of them.
You'd have to. That's what I was thinking.
But we have nurse case managers who report to an internal medicine physician, plus we have two family practice physicians also that work as managers. And cases that go into the hospital, and we check the hospital admissions every day. Cases that go into the hospital get immediate nurse attention, and they begin managing those patients throughout their hospital stay in terms of making sure that lab reports get back to the charts, making sure that if a physician is ready to discharge his patient on Friday afternoon, they aren't held over the weekend until they get transportation on Monday, making sure that they work with discharge planners at the hospital so that there's a place for the patient to go. When we know of a baby that goes into the neonatal intensive care, we have a nurse that's assigned just for doing neonatal intensive care management of these babies. So they work with them throughout their stay, and some of them are very expensive, as much as $500,000 a stay. So the nurse stays with them through that whole process. We also have our case managers works with other patients who might have catastrophic or large injuries or diseases that looks like it's going to be a long chronic care process, and some of them can go quite long. Our case managers also work whenever we have a patient that, say, is a transplant patient that might go to University of Washington in Seattle or to Portland. If our case managers work with the people, our physicians and case managers work with the physicians and staff in those places to make sure that care, that they don't do experimental therapy on these patients, for example, and then bill us for it, and they want to start experimental therapy all the time. That's just a real broad brush, but does that help?
Yes. I was thinking that it would be falling on the shoulders of the nurse, and with the nursing shortage, I was just curious with the demand that would be needed if we expanded your pilot program. Is that an issue?
In terms of finding the
enough nurses skills to cover the patients that you have?
There's no question that skilled case manager, RN case managers, are hard to find, but certainly we have as much opportunity to find them as anyone. but there is a small pool of really good people.
Thank you. From.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The ERISA that you were speaking of, the insurance provider that you're providing.
I'm sorry, please say again.
ERISA, was that you called it, right?
Yes.
Did you also provide mental health services, mental health coverage?
We contract with mental health organizations or employee. It's the employee, what do they call them?
Assistance program.
Employee assistance program companies who provide those services. We don't. So we will contract with employee assistance program who acts as really the triage for those patients to get them to mental health. But we pay the bill for the mental health service.
Thank you.
Yes.
Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your document here, the elements of a draft document, last page 4, you make one of the barriers to a fully integrated and efficient service system. Your last bullet there, administrative rules and requirements have become an excessive burden and lower productivity to approximately 55% for contracted providers. Have you got any kind of study or documentation or a breakdown on those?
Um,
representative. this is, and I spoke to this a little bit when I was here last time. For a mental health provider, about 45 to 50% of their time is non-direct service time. Some of that is supervision, some of it is team meetings, a lot of it is paperwork, some of it is from no-shows. The more that administrative documentation issues are put on to a provider, the more time they have to spend doing that. We've talked for years, I see that Ralph Summers has arrived, and tried to figure out what would be legal ways to reduce the administrative burden, because a lot of the requirements are federal requirements. My personal stand is that we ought to expect, and particularly now, I haven't always advocated for this, but the minimum amount of reporting requirements rather than sort of the maximum amount. If a therapist could add two patients a week, it would just, it would reduce the costs in the system somewhat significantly. It would be that many fewer therapists out there, and agencies would be, the benefit here is really for the provider agency. Their budgets would be more sound. If you're asking if I have any specific areas where things could be reduced, I don't, because I run into a wall, which I think is a real wall, is that these are federal requirements.
Thank you.
One suggestion I've had is there must be someone out there who has experience in helping systems determine the minimum amount, the minimum response that's required to be in full compliance with federal regulations, rather than trying to have a maximum response or to protect everyone from, the legal liability type of issues we're worried about.
Thanks.
Terry, how many different employers do you serve?
Mr. Chairman,
you take into your managed care?
We have about somewhere between 7,000 and 8,000 covered lives where we have direct contracts with employers.
Okay, that tells me how many employees. I ask you how many employers.
Well, the reason I didn't break it down is because one of the companies is a nursing home company and has nursing homes throughout. I don't know how many there are, but there is three corporate entities, but a number of different business.
Fine. And then how many fee-for-service do you anticipate are in Lane County, open cards?
Somewhere between 6,000 and 9,000.
How big's Lane County?
Total, I think there's 215.
I think it's now 326,000.
Somewhere in that neighborhood, yeah.
You guys are doing an awful good job of bringing them in out of fee-for-service into managed care, or I think you've got a lot more. Based on my county's numbers and percentages, because we're running about 25% in COIS's area.
Mr. Chair, Lane County is a closed county.
Right. You've got some geographic anomalies and advantages. I fully appreciate that. Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you characterize your relationship between your commercial carriers that you manage and what it's like to manage for the state, basically for the Medicaid population, as far as the amount of administrative cost you have, what it's like when they come to audit you, what that relationship is like from your point of view, with a slant to thinking what you could take over from the state or not take over from the state if you had a free hand in this, and comparing those two different types of vehicles, but yet the patients you're managing are very similar, and what you're doing with them is very similar.
Well, Representative Bates, it's the difference in the medical difference in the populations are pretty significant, in that about 40 to 50% of our cost on the OHP side is perinatal related. So that means there's a huge different focus in our management for these patients. On the administrative side, it's much less administrative cost on commercial health plan contracts that we have. And I mean, there are a lot of differences. You know, I second what, and third and fourth, what Bruce was saying about the rules and regulations. But I would say even considering that, I mean, OMAP does an outstanding job. But I think in terms of the governmental regulations, there's an interpretation of the governmental regulation, and there's interpretations that are less, you know, strict. I would say there's a lot of room to help reduce our costs under admin, which is much higher under OMAP than it is the commercial health plans. I will give you one example. When we have, as a delegated entity, when we have a review and inspection, an annual review and inspection from a commercial health plan, much of the work is done by email and by mail over the phone, where we transfer documents to them. They get back to us. They have questions for us. And there may be a 1 or 2 hour on-site visit where they sit down and want to go over something. When we have annual review from OMAP, four people show up and spend 2 days and do less work than what the commercial plans do. Not that they're doing a good job or goofing off. It's just a style that we can adapt, I think. I'm trying to say that without being critical. But there are administrative costs in OMAP that we don't have in the commercial health plans.
Mr. Chair. Mallo?
Yes.
I'm going to try to phrase this in a way that will be politically correct, or whatever way you want to take this. If we asked you to assume some of the duties that you presently perceive that OMAP is doing, do you have any idea what kind of federal regulations would still stand in your way? I mean, what would you still have from them you cannot do yourself? What could you take over yourself in a way to be more efficient?
Representative Bates, there is a role for everyone. There are things that should be done centrally at the state level and things that should be done at the community level. On the medical side, there's a number of case management things, for example, that really should be managed centrally at OMAP. For example, there may be 3 Gaucher's disease in the state of Oregon. And so Coos Bay shouldn't have to manage one of those. That should be managed centrally, you know, with an expert staff at OMAP level. But for urinary tract infections, they should be managed in the community. So there should be a division of who manages what. But for the catastrophic and rare disease things, probably a centralized management on the medical side would work at the state. But everything else should be done at the community level. On the administrative side, OMAP is expert at their interface with CMS, for example, and should remain to be the interface with CMS. And there are certain children's programs, for example, that they should continue to manage. But there is a lot of the other things, the reporting things, reporting requirements that we could actually, the fully capitated health plans can actually manage the data better and put those reporting capabilities in place that would actually be more effective, more costly, and give you more meaningful information than what we can get now. But there's a variety of things that you could split up.
Mr. Chair. Representative Bates.
If we asked for a sort of a reversal of a reverse RFP, could you provide one for us, listing those things that you think the managed care plan could reasonably assume and what the cost of that would be, or whether you could even do it under administrative cap because there would be savings to you based on less administrative overhead for you?
Yes, sir, we could do that.
Representative Greenlick. Good question, by the way, Representative Bates.
You've got a fascinating hypothesis here, and it, on its face, seems very innovative. I'm not familiar with, I mean, there have been small experiments like this. We're talking about taking on a pretty grand scale with some pretty big dollars on a hypothesis without a lot of experience. How confident are you? What level of confidence do you put that you can really get things like the forensic and the really severely mentally ill and get them all together and really make it go? How confident are you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I think we're fairly confident, but remember, what we're showing you today is a concept. What we're looking at is the data to make sure we can do it. I think what uniquely we have different, we're the only county in the state that owns its own psychiatric hospital. We own subacute facilities. We own some residential facilities. We have a sheriff's office that works with us very well that has mental health staff internally. We have jail capacity that can be might be able to be converted for a forensics unit. So it's one of these sort of things that the stars are lining up. And it's one of these oddities that if we can't do it now, we probably can't do it for years. So that gives us our confidence. But one of the things that could happen, too, we could get a reality check relatively soon that when we start calculating it, it won't quite work the way we think. But to a certain degree, having said that, when we looked at managed care years ago when we became an MHO, we really didn't have any experience in doing it that way. What I'm actually more worried about is not that. I'm actually more worried about the service delivery model, coordination. And maybe that's what you're talking about. I think we will do relatively well around the forensic side, working with the sheriff's office and other issues with the state. Well, I'm personally, just to let you know, what I'm more worried about is making sure we somehow integrate as equal partners the alcohol and drug providers into our system, and that's going to be a trick without them having to feel like they're left out or, you know, our stepchildren or something. That's going to be an interesting part.
And integrating with Terry.
And integrating with physical. Yeah, part of it, it's how we overlap. And obviously, one of the things we have in common is you're spending public money, you have a lot of the common client. Whether or not they're covered under the Oregon Health Plan, or they're appearing, for example, in my public health clinic for communicable disease, or they're in a methadone clinic, you know, they're all kinds of different places. And what we have in common is we're using public money to buy health services.
Right.
Mr. Chair?
We got a quick one. I promise these gentlemen they'd be out of here at 4:30.
I think, Mr. Chair, that she who must be obeyed has entered the room and this meeting is rapidly drawing to an end. Is that correct?
Well, seriously, thank you very much. And we'll obviously be talking about risk, reward, how this whole thing goes together. And as always, we appreciate you coming up from Eugene. Appreciate, you know, you're very, you know, intelligent, creative. We need this, you know, insight and input in this very difficult process. And I'm still hoping, but I'm not betting on you, Terry, that this isn't going to be harder than I think. But so thank you very much. Committee, we have one more agenda item with us today. I'd like to call Amelia Abel, B.J. Westland, and Taylor Westland to the stand immediately, please.
You're supposed to tell the truth, too.
Now, Amelia, you might think that we had your dad down here because we are interested in what he had to say. The only two guys in the room that understood it were the guys that were sitting next to him. Especially with all those initial things. What we really wanted to know, and this is important, is where are you going on vacation?
Okay.
You got to talk right into the microphone.
I have a disability, and it's been kind of hard for me. And I got born with it, and sometimes my school has promised me what I'm talking about, and you know, sometimes disability has like have hard time muscles, and it's kind of sore for me, and just makes me kind of like shiver because my other friends who are scared for me, but some people who I don't know who make me kind of jealous because I'm kind of strange and for no reason. So I kind of feel kind of different because I got born with disability, and I just kind of feel like disability and kind of make me feel special.
What?
Having disabilities, and I have friends that have disabilities too, and that's all what I want to say, and what I have, what I go on with.
Well, you did a very good job. And you too. You just come back from vacation. Where have you come from?
This is being televised all over the building. Don't be nervous.
There are only tens of thousands of people that are watching you right now. Taylor Westland.
Washington.
Well, you got to speak right into the microphone.
Washington.
That's an awfully vague answer. Where in Washington?
The coast.
The beach.
Long Beach? Okay.
And BJ Westland. Remember,
guy asking questions.
There's only tens of thousands of people watching you, so don't be nervous. Did you have a good time?
Yes.
We don't accept one-word answers in the legislature.
I have a follow-up question.
A follow-up question. Representative March.
BJ, did you see the alligator boy at the Marsh Museum?
Yes, I did.
Okay, good.
I think that was Taylor's favorite. Well, Amelia, you did exceptional. Taylor, you did a very good job. BJ, we'll talk later. Thank you for gracing us with your presence. You guys have a good time on your spring break. Any other business come before the committee? Seeing none, we're adjourned.
Thank you for speaking.